Island, Noel Coward's Waiting in the Wings, and Bernardo Cubría's dark and incisive new comedy, The People of Pompeii, set in the aftermath of the 2025 Palisades fire. Seatricum is located in Topanga Canyon, just off the 101 freeway, in the shade of the California live oaks. Explore and picnic in the gardens before the show. Further information available at www.seatricum.com and at kpfk.org.
FM, KPFK, Los Angeles.
This is Feminist Magazine, a weekly radical radio show and podcast produced by a diverse collective of feminists. And every week, we bring you a mix of intersectional stories and guests to help you resist and engage. And I'm Lynn Harris-Ballin, your host today, and this is what feminism can sound like.
Earlier this year, news emerged about Cesar Chavez, former leader of the United Farm Workers Movement. The news emerged that he had sexually abused many young women, including Dolores Huerta, in the late 1960s and early 70s. I'm Leilani Albano, and today we talk to Yolanda Alaniz. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm really glad to be here.
A New York Times article chronicled Cesar Chavez's sexual abuse revelations. It reported that UFW co-founder Dolores Huerta was raped twice in the 1960s by Chavez. Also, Ana Murguia and Deborah Rojas, now in their 60s, were young girls when they were raped by Chavez. Did the revelation shock you?
Somewhat, but not really, because of the historical dynamics of that union from the very beginning, which we're going to go into, but the factors that laid the basis and the historical connections it made with other things that were going on at the time and other people that factored in, including the Catholic Church, the Democratic Party, and all of those things factored into what happened, I think, the lack of democracy, tossing out the radicals, all of that had a bearing into what happened. As the news reporting said in the New York Times that was published March 18th, 2026, mentioned. So it wasn't quite a total surprise because I've been following the farm worker movement for a long time. But, your ears will end up, your problems will finally show at the very end of something. And that's what happened,
Well, for many, he didn't seem to have that many errors or any errors at all. In public, he was the farm worker leader, seen as a champion for human and labor rights. But for many girls and women, he was a sexual predator. How did this happen?
It's like asking, how did the Epstein files happen? How did those women happen? I think it points to a bigger problem in society, but in this specific case, I think because he was so trusted by the people around him, and he was actually, because Catholicism had such a big role in setting policy for the farm worker movement, the United Farm Worker Union, that they held him almost as a saint. So he couldn't be criticized. He couldn't do no wrong. So therefore, you're not going to, even speculate that he could do something like this. So that's the problem. You can't trust people entirely, and you can't trust a movement entirely. You have to make sure there's checks and balances. And there wasn't. He was basically how the government's being run right now. You're loyal. You don't criticize. It's how he ran the union.
Yes, I guess the more specific question is, how could this happen? And how could this happen in union and progressive spaces? Because for a lot of people, the expectations are so much higher for leaders in these spaces.
Well, sexism and misogyny and all the rest of it, homophobia, transphobia, all of that we're all influenced by that, right? Because we live in that kind of system that promotes that kind of behavior. So nobody's insular against that. You know, we're all affected by the isms of our society. So it's a reflection of what happens in society. I'm sure there's a lot more women that are going to come out. Other organizations have dealt with this. It's not a new thing. But to keep it silent is I think, the real problem. And I'm glad these women, they were young then, but I'm glad these women in their 60s and Dolores, who's approaching her 90s, I think it's very brave of them to speak out now. At least they did now.
Well, there are going to be some naysayers out there who may say, you know, why talk about this now? Why bring back bad memories or memories that a lot of people didn't even know about? I mean, after all, we are living in the age of Trump and Latinos are getting attacked all the time. Shouldn't we just keep a lid on it?
Well, you could try that method. I mean, certainly Cesar Chavez tried that method and he came back and bit him in the butt, even though he's deceased. You can't keep something like this under wraps. It's not fair to the individuals involved in the movement. It's not fair to the leadership of women who were in that spaces. And it's not fair to the families who've been shattered by this revelation. And it has to be dealt with, because you can't have a democratic organization and something that's going to sustain itself if you don't deal with the problems that occur up front. And when you don't, like even in the left, you know, acts of racism and sexism have broken up many organizations on the left, including. So if you don't deal with this, it will have a negative effect.
So tell us about Chavez's leadership. He was criticized later on for his leadership approach, but in his early years, you wrote that the UFW was brilliant under his leadership. Tell us about that.
Well, Megan and I co-authored this book, Viva la Raza, History of Chicano Identity and Resistance. And Megan Cornish was the co-author with me, and Rudy Acuña wrote the foreword, considered the godfather of Chicano history. And this was published in 2008 by Red Letter Press. And there's a good section in here. There's a good section on the United Farm Workers Union. No one had done what he did. And he didn't do it alone. So if I said brilliant, yeah, you want to recognize what he did. But, you know, before him, Filipinos were organizing a union and actually started the Delano strike before Chavez even got involved. Larry, and I forgot his last name. You might remember his last name.
Ed Leon?
Yes,
Larry,
yes. Leon. He was a big part of the organizing the farm workers before they collaborated with Cesar Chavez's organizing workers' efforts. So his leadership was vital to the movement, because we don't have that many Chicano and Chicana leaders that are, you know, kind of out there. There are many, but you have to dig for them. But he was very well recognized, and they did some wonderful things. I mean, you know, they got union contracts, they brought attention to farm workers' struggle, housing, the pesticides, their low wages, not being part of the National Labor Relations Board. Safety was a big one. I mean, they brought up those issues that had not really crystallized like they were under his leadership. But again, he didn't do it alone, right?
But the approach you described was that there was tenacity, tactical flexibility, high-powered organizing. It seemed like the approach was working.
It was working to an extent, but then he changed all that. You know, I mean, who was making policy at that time was more the United Farm Workers rank and file and the people he had around him. That changed. And once it changed, the union character and the mission changed, because he led in the Catholic Church to set policy and become the staff instead of the workers. A lot of the Catholic, you know, nuns and priests came in, very conservative attitudes about women, about the movement, very pacifist. So the militancy was gone. he did not only red baiting, was the whole McCarthy era where he got rid of the radicals and the quote communists. And those, some were communists, yes, some were not. There just was, you know, had a different opinion, but they were considered, you know, a threat to him. So he got rid of them. So that was a big part of it. Then the other big part was, you know, the allegiance to the Democratic Party. Once they became an FLCIO affiliate, they were pressured to be under them. That meant supporting the Democratic Party, raising funds for the Democratic Party. So that changed the whole focus of their union in terms of keeping the struggle for union organizing and even calling, even doing boycotts. They did boycotts, but then they didn't organize unions and they didn't organize contracts. So it was kind of like this piecemeal that kind of fell apart.
So you had mentioned Filipinos. How did the relationship change as you stated that he retreated from militant action? How did his relationship change with Filipinos at the time?
Well, because they were more radical. You know, they were against the Marcos regime. And he supported, he visited Marcos. That was a slap in the face to all the Filipino organizers. So, you know, of course they were going to, not only were they witch hunted out, but they, I'm sure, also left on their own accord after that. He betrayed them.
But what can account for this retreat from militant action? So we see that it happened. Was there some kind of reckoning? Well, what was the change and why was there the change?
You know, every organization faces, you know, are you going to go the more radical role or are you going to go the more conservative reformist role, right? And he chose to go in the more reformist role. And that meant abiding by trying to get respectability for the union and trying to fight for reforms that were not too radical. And that changed the character. And why he did that, I mean, I don't know for sure, but there's pressure to conform. We all feel that, right? The pressure to not say anything wrong because Trump is going to pick on you, not say anything wrong because your boss is going to pick on you. I mean, all those pressures are there. And he took it to the, you know, to the ultimate limit in terms of getting rid of the militancy that the union had at the beginning. And there, like I said before, there was no checks and balances. So he got to organize his own paradise of what he wanted in him in leadership and him being the almost like a cult leader. I'm sorry to say that, but it was because people weren't challenging him the way they needed to, because to be loyal, you don't criticize. And that's not really democracy. Once a union doesn't have democracy, you are done for.
Right. And I guess what's surprising for people who don't know about his early history, he also led campaigns against undocumented workers.
Oh, yes.
Tell us about that. Why did he do that?
Well, he saw, quote, illegal aliens, and that's what he called them. He saw undocumented workers coming to, they were coming to take jobs away from the farm workers, because a lot of them, of course, came to do cheap labor. So instead of trying to organize and work with them, he would call the INS, the former.
What's that?
It's like the Migra. It's like ICE.
Okay.
INS okay. at the time. So he got a lot of negative response from the Chicano movement and Chicano leaders. And even his own ranks for doing that. So we had to back off that kind of policy. But he really saw them as a threat instead of organizing with them and making sure that they were also protected, which was a better strategy. And as we've seen, a lot of immigrants that have come to the United States have been militant and have been the backbone of a lot of strong union movements, like the janitors, the healthcare workers, housekeeping. That's the backbone are women and immigrants. And you have to organize with them, not fight them.
Well, it seems like it was a tactical strategy as well, because back to what you were saying, that, you know, he was into respectability politics. And so maybe that kind of followed along about, you know, being respectable in the wider realm, you had to go against undocumented people.
Yes and no. He didn't have to. There was a lot of support to do otherwise, but he chose to do that, like you said, to keep, you know, to keep his respectability. And he caved into a lot of the union. A lot of unions were doing that, right? They were, when undocumented workers were coming, they were not very pleased with it. But nobody else does the jobs that they do. So they weren't really taking away American jobs or U.S. jobs. So that's a really false statement.
So as part of these changes, this retreat from militant action, they also saw a decline in union democracy. And you stated that this led to Chavez's increased efforts to control others, including women. Can you tell us about that?
Well, like any union, if you don't have the ranks to be able to speak up and correct leadership, then leadership's going to do whatever they want. And a lot of conservative elements are a factor in their decisions. So, and that's what happened. The lack of democracy came with no criticism. And it doesn't have to be like, F you. It's kind of like, you know, let's rethink this policy. Shouldn't we organize with undocumented workers rather than calling out, you know, ICE on them and getting them arrested? Should we not, you know, try to work with them and increase our numbers as a union? But you can't have that discussion if everything he saw was a criticism. He only had people that were yes, sir, you know, kind of people, like our current administration.
So the particular two women,
uh-huh.
How was that control?
Well, that was a Catholic, that was
them.
Full-blown Catholic Church. You know, I mean, once the Catholic Church got involved, I mean, not that all Chicanos and Latinos are Catholic. They're not. That was also another mistake that he made. My mother was, you know, her father was a Protestant minister. So, you know, yes, I became Catholic, now an ex-Catholic, but there are other religions too. But in terms of women, it was a way to control women, because the Catholic Church, you know, their line is, you know, produce babies, stay at home, don't work, take care of your husband, clean the house, don't have a job, which, of course, a lot of Chicano families have to have two people working, like most families. You know, don't have an abortion. All those things become a mortal sin. So once they got involved, that sexism and that way of treating women became how the union did things, unfortunately.
And you spoke about sexual aggression.
Right.
As a form of control and it being about power relations, how does that relate to Cesar Chavez?
Well, I worked for Seattle Rape Relief for many years in Seattle a long time ago. And it is a power relationship. It's when your supervisor, for instance, there's a power relationship if you're the employee, right? So they can say things and you have to think, well, do I want to challenge that? Because, quote, do I want to keep my job or not? I mean, you have to have union protection for that. And he was not the kind that he saw women as secondary. I mean, Dolores Huerta had to fight like hell, tooth and nail, to get into leadership. But there's very few women that made her statue in the union. They didn't make it that far because of the sexism. And I think that has a lot to do with not only Chicano culture in general, but the influence of the Catholic Church and their policies regarding women.
Well, I find it interesting that you would define sexual aggression even outside of the of sexual violence.
Oh, yeah.
You know, from the rape and the pedophilia that happened. You're saying even just in the relationships that the leaders had with women, that there was a form of sexual aggression.
Oh, yeah, because men have the power in this society, and they think of us as very second class. And the power relationships that you can dominate women and control them is, you know, is basic to U.S. capitalism and how they see women. We're to be tamed, not supported for our militancy and for our big mouths, you know, having strong opinions, you know. So there's always a power relationship because men are always trying to be, not in this is in general, and I'm not speaking for every man, but in this society, men hold the power and they try to keep women down. And that's a power relationship. And they want control. And that's why rape and sexual abuse still goes on to this day, because men think that women are property. And capitalism treats women as property. You know, we had a fight for the vote. We had a fight to own land. We had a fight to own our own businesses, to keep our children after divorce. All those things we had to do. Fight for, you know, bodily autonomy, to have an abortion. All those things that were fought for by previous militants, you know, that came before us. And that's something that, unfortunately, some men feel very threatened by. And unfortunately, the system we live under perpetuates that power relationships between men and women. And
even in union spaces.
Yes, even in union spaces. I remember being in my union in Seattle that I did for many, many years. I was always had union jobs, but I worked for the city of Seattle for 15 years, and I was in a union, very somewhat progressive, but I used to have fights over wanting the union to take a position to be part of the gay and lesbian march, the gay pride march. And I would come in with my proposal. I would round up support to other union members. And then we would have a knockdown, drag out fight. I would be eye to eye with my union rep, who was a really tall guy. I was down here. We would go at it. And the president one time just said, take it outside. Here we are debating that the union take a position. All of a sudden it becomes a battle between him and I, and we're supposed to take it outside. What? So he can beat me up? What? What was that about? And of course, now the union does it, you know, automatically does support for gay pride. But before that, in the early days, we had to fight like hell and justify it.
Yeah. For everything.
Yep. Just again, the union movement is influenced by the Democratic Party. So they're supposed to raise money and put in these ponchos that they say they're going to do something for union people or working people. They get into office and forget all their promises. So it's like you bank on these people, you still support them with money, and you vote for them, and you're expecting a different result. And it's not. It's never going to change.
You grew up in the farm fields of Sunnyside, Washington, and Yakima Valley before heading off to college and joining the student group Mecha and becoming active in your union. What were your experiences?
Well, the established union on campus was not meeting the needs of women, especially women of color. So I helped organize an independent union called United Workers Union Independent to represent the most depressed and mainly people of color on campus, because the mainstream union was not doing it. So my experience is that if a current union is not doing it, organize your own. We grew up very poor as a farm worker family. My family, like a lot of Chicanos in the 50s, migrated from Texas up to, we would work the fields in California, Oregon, and Washington, and settled in Washington when my father got a job building one of the dams. So we stayed there, and my mother was always involved with the Chicano community, always standing up for helping people. She was always very active in helping the farm workers who couldn't speak English or didn't know how to fill out forms or how to pay their bills. She was always available to help them. So I guess I just learned from an early age, you help people, you help others who are actually more unfortunate than you are. We were poor, but they were even poorer, right? I mean, at least we knew English, and, you know, mom knew the system somewhat. But it's a very hard life, because you're living in camps that have, you know, at that point, didn't have any running water, had a wood stove, you had to cut up the wood for it, dirt floors, tin roofs. I mean, you know, it was pretty horrible. But now it's a little bit better, but still, you know, they still need better housing, better wages, and safety in terms of pesticides. I'm sure that's why my stepfather got cancer, because he worked in the fields and always had that pesticide around him.
And then you graduated from high school, and you went off to college and joined Mecha. How was that?
Well, I got recruited by the Equal Opportunity Program. There was code affirmative action at the time. So a bunch of Chicanos got recruited to go to the University of Washington, and we got a scholarship, so we didn't have to pay very much. And that's how I got to the University of Washington and started to become very active with the Chicano movement itself, demanding ethnic studies, affirmative action, housing for students, childcare for working mothers who were students. And then I got involved with Radical Women, social feminist organization, when we were fighting for student fees to help pay for childcare. Standing up for that, and I felt very united with them in the cause for that. And then I also joined Mecha and helped organize MUHED, a Chicano organization in the community.
How was that, organizing with Mecha?
In the 70s, you got to remember, this is the 70s, so the men were very sexist, you know. They were just like, if you read, you know, read things about the Black Panther Party, you know, women were in the background doing, you know, the paperwork and the mimeing and the cooking and all that. We weren't supposed to have, you know, real leadership roles. So that was a real conflict for me because that wasn't going to work for me. But they did offer a training to be militant and organize the Chicano community. And they stood up for some really good things on campus in terms of fighting for, like I said, ethnic studies, a cultural center, a library for a cultural center. So they really came out with some really good issues. But unfortunately, they, like other organizations, it wasn't just NECHA, were influenced by the sexism of the movement in the 70s. And unfortunately, the left at that time was also a big part of that, because the Socialist Workers Party was just putting up men as their, you know, as the one who did talking and influenced the political scene. And women were kept out of it. So that's why I joined Radical Women, because I wanted to have a voice and be part of the women's movement.
This was about the same time of Cesar Chavez's reign, correct? Was there a culture that supported women victims at the time?
I don't remember that there was. Everything was hush-hush. There wasn't that support like the Me Too movement or, I mean, there was Seattle Rape Relief, but that came in later in the 70s. But when I was on campus, not a whole lot.
Knowing what you know, could this happen again?
Yes, it could. I mean, it's happening all the time, right? It just, some women speak up and some don't. It's never going to go away as long as we live under patriarchy that treats women the way they do, that the system, you know, forces, I think, men to treat women the way they do. We're not born racist or sexist or misogynist or, you know, with all these phobias, but we learn that. And then, yes, it can happen as long as we have the kind of system we have, unfortunately. And that's why it's important to always have a strong women's movement or a strong Chicano movement or a strong Black or Filipino, Asian American, Indigenous movement to counter the isms, to counter the evils of capitalism. That's how we can do it. And unfortunately, until we have a new system that we can be more equal and respected as who we are and not judged by having a vagina, right?
Well, I'm going to push back a little
okay.
bit, and some people will say, you know what? Decades later, we have a Me Too movement. We had the gay liberation movement. We had all of these movements that were based on race. And the unions, for better or for worse, have improved. And so we would think automatically that we would not have a Cesar Chavez rise again. What do you say to that?
Well, we had the Epstein files, you know. And we, every day you'll hear somebody, you know, abuse somebody or somebody rapes somebody. So it still happens. It's a reflection of our society. And it's bigger than a union. It's bigger than you and I. It's all around us. I mean, we can do what we can to try to stop it and create reforms. But as we're seeing, all reforms are being taken away from us. All workers' rights, abortion rights, all those things are being taken away from us. And it's 2026. So people think, well, yes, we've progressed, and we have. You know, we've done a lot of work to get where we're at today. I don't take that away from anybody. But all of those reforms could be taken away from us in a minute. It depends on the current administration. That's what they're doing. So we're still kind of in the same boat until we change the power relationships of this system, which means that the bourgeois class is always over the proletariat class, right? We have to get rid of that class dynamic. And that means we have to have a different economic system that values human beings and our work and respect us for who we are and let us live our lives the way we want.
But until then, since we don't have all of those things in place, what steps can the United Farm Workers take to address the sexual abuse?
Well, what I said in my radical statement that I wrote on this topic was they need to call a tribunal, you know, bring together the rank and file and have them decide what they want to do about this issue. So it should bring in not only United Farm Workers Union, but other people in the community, those affected, maybe the families. What do they want to see happen? You know, what changes do they want? Obviously, the union itself is no longer kind of a union anymore. And I want to just emphasize, a union without democracy leads to failure for the membership. The only way the membership can let its voice be heard and to correct the leadership is by having a voice in their union. But if you take that voice away because they're women, are lesbians and gays, or transgender, are they radicals, or they're communists, you not only fail the membership, but your union will not last.
I'm Leilani Albano, and today we talk to Yolanda Alaniz.
Thanks so much for joining the show.
Thank you very much.
As the go-to media outlet for Southern California progressive thinkers since 1959, KPFK is very proud of its legacy. But maintaining that legacy can be expensive. Become part of the KPFK community today by donating at kpfk.org. Just click on the Support KPFK button on the website to send your gift today. Because while ignorance can be costly, speaking truth to power is priceless.
This is Sita Michelle Coltrane inviting you to join me for a very special extended edition of Awakenings. This Saturday, August 29th, we are expanding our time from 4 a.m. to 6 a.m. to celebrate a milestone very close to my heart, the birthday and cosmic musical legacy of my mother, Alice Coltrane. We'll dive deep into her timeless compositions, her spiritual vision, and the music that continues to elevate the collective consciousness. It's the perfect soundtrack for the dawn of a new day. Join me for this special two-hour Awakenings that Saturday morning, August 29th, from 4 a.m. to 6 a.m. on KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles, and streaming globally on the web at kpfk.org.
You're listening to Feminist Magazine on KPFK on 90.7 FM and kpfk.org.
My name is Kendall Morgan, and today we ask, what is the role of the artist in revolutionary socio-political movements? We'll be in conversation with very talented artists about their respective journeys in the time of COVID. They are Bay Area native and Filipinx muralist Sammy C., Hawaiian native Reiki master and mixed media artist Denise Asio. We'll be discussing how they are using their mediums to support radical change. We'll be exploring alternative ways of being and creating in this new world shift we are all experiencing. We start with Sammy C. If you could just tell folks a little bit about your work and what communities you identify with and move within.
Absolutely. I am a mixed media artist. I'm from Ramatish Ohlone territory in San Francisco, California. I'm currently speaking to you on Huichin Ohlone territory in Oakland, California. And I'm an artist that follows the tradition and the legacy of muralism and public art. And most of my work centers on uplifting stories and working to create spaces for unheard stories to exist and to inform and influence creative expressions that come through me. So I do a lot of audio narrative recording, just like you. And I also illustrate and paint the powerful lessons and journeys and insights that folks share with me. As a Filipinx American, I'm deeply connected to the Bay Area Filipino American community. I'm also a healer. So most of my circles and communities are folks that are using traditional healing, you know, culturally sensitive healing modalities, non-pharmaceutical healing modalities to self-heal and heal one another as well as the earth. Also my creative community of Bay Area muralists that are strongly led by many, many elders who've been doing this work of public art and telling our stories on the walls for decades and decades. Those are the folks who hold me and who I work amongst.
As a muralist, especially, and as someone whose work is mostly done in public spaces and in community, I'm really curious how your work has evolved given this moment in the time of COVID and shelter in place and also the explosion of the Black Lives Matter movement.
It's been a huge change, as it has for everybody. And my creative practice has responded, you know, in those synchronistic ways to the way that the world is changing, both with COVID and with the uprising in response to centuries of racial injustice against Black folks. My work, creative work, it was like a deep exhale and a deep inhale all the way through, right? So right as COVID hit, I felt like I exhaled everything out of me. I was so shocked and so upset and angry and appalled at what I was seeing in terms of disparities and accessibility and the poor, you know, distribution of response, of healing response here in the U.S. And so I really pulled all of my creative work back in. I wasn't making a lot of art, right? Most of my gigs were canceled, my mural gigs, installation gigs. I lost two shows that I had been cultivating artwork towards already for 6-7 months. And I kind of felt myself pause, really stop. And then, you know, slowly, as we've started to stabilize and have more information and understand the scope and the scale of how COVID as a virus and racism as a virus are, you know, continually injecting harm into our lives, I realized that my creative expression and my creative artwork, as it always has been, is the balm and an antidote to that harm that's being perpetuated all around us. I, you know, resumed taking the duty of being an artist as a forefront of my contributions to this time by looking at the lines of work that I was already creating and trying to inspect them and pivot them in a way to offer more of the energy that I'm able to bring forth to support the well-being of myself and the folks who are in my community that are in relationship to my artwork. So, for example, I had a project that was about uplifting narratives of Filipinx American Pinay women and thinking about what lessons that they have received from elder women in their lineage. And so I had collected all of these narratives. I was making artwork around these narratives and I want to release them. But what I decided to do was really slow down, try to hold the narratives and listen again. And from the deeper listening, I created meditations from the lessons that I received in those stories that are about calming our nervous system, investigating our own internal body awareness, investigating our own histories, and investigating our own relationships to our cultural identities and cultural understandings and knowings of anti-Blackness that are sometimes perpetuated. I really wanted to think about in what ways are anti-Blackness perpetuated in Filipinx American communities, and how can I hold stories that are shared with me and create reflective spaces where we can see the truth in ourselves and both celebrate our love that we hold and carry from our culture and our tradition, but also investigate and exercise some of the harmful, violent lessons and knowings that we have also received through our cultural narratives as well.
I guess I want to riff off of something that you had just said about the importance for you and your work about uplifting voices and resources that are already in place in a community, and really looking to elders for guidance and as keepers of story. If you could speak to the importance of this.
I think a lot about the role of the artist as a relational healer. So thinking about if my calling and my responsibility is to hold stories and to hear stories, what work must I do and what relationships must I have in order to hold those stories in a good way? It's important to me to deeply cultivate relationships with a place that I'm going to be working in and do my due diligence to learn the history of the land that I'm on, the history of the people, the indigenous people, to learn and not expect those people to educate me on their history, to come with a baseline of knowing of how their struggle is also my struggle. And you know, I see artists who have done this and have changed our whole lives and shifted culture. You know, Emery Douglas, right? He created visual icons that are invitations for individuals to be in relationship to what Black communities need to thrive, right? Art is an extension of how we invite people to be in relationship to a place, to one another, even to ourselves, to our histories. And creating more equitable, loving, just relationships through art will heal some of the wounds that we're all collectively experiencing. You know, my responsibility as a community-based artist is to really think deeply in every single step of my work and try to understand how might my biases and my privilege be harmful to the people that I'm working with? My intention might be good, but my actions and my knowing and my conditioning may still require work. It does still require work. So part of that responsibility of working in communities is to be deeply humble and to come as a student, to listen really deeply. It's true, you know, public art, street art, even graffiti, some elements of the traditions that I'm informed by, they both insert themselves into public spaces, sometimes invited, sometimes uninvited. And I think we need to reflect on the impact of being uninvited to a place and how it replicates colonial histories, and recognizing that we may be re-traumatizing folks. So paint where you feel called to paint, but know that you will get a lesson if you're not supposed to paint there. When you paint, the community will speak to you and tell you if you're doing a good job. That's the nature of public art. The wind will tell you. The earth will tell you. The wall will tell you if you're supposed to paint there. And it's your job to listen to the voices of both the land and the people who are there. And if they are affirming you and saying, thank you, we appreciate this, this is a service to us, you may be doing this in a good way. If you're not, then they will tell you, you know, and it's your duty to listen and do better.
We are in conversation with Bay Area muralist Sammy C about what she calls her responsibility as a community-based artist. I'd just like to ask how this moment has maybe transformed your beliefs about what is possible as far as ways of being and creating in the world for both you personally and also for society as a whole, you know.
I've experienced a lot of shifts recently, and a big one has to do with the tremendous amount of work and labor that has been done for decades by activists and organizers around the abolition movement and folks who have been working diligently to wait for a moment like this so that their decades of work may be seeded and that public consciousness, that mass consciousness may hold the possibility of seeing a world, of seeing our communities without police, without the prison industrial complex traumatizing and violating communities, without the death penalty, you know, without carceral punishments that are deeply, deeply scarring generations. I'm very grateful to those voices who have uplifted educational resources to see in what ways we as people or as communities perpetuate and replicate the values and violence that are rooted in the belief and value of police. That's been a big change for me, seeing and educating myself in the language and the history of the abolition movement, as well as thinking about what's next and creating artwork about, you know, what does it look like? What kind of skills do we need to cultivate in order to prepare ourselves and till the soil for the future generations? So being a part of those conversations, making art around that has really changed in this time. Also, a big change for me is being a part of institutions for my bread and butter. I work in academic institutions and really seeing and listening to the ways in which institutions are echoing the call for justice, equity, and the end of white supremacy is both really exciting to me, but it's also very dangerous to me. We see these big institutions and corporations and businesses all around us and brands co-opting and remarketing the movement right back at us. We must stay really vigilant and not allow for lip service to stand as anything but that.
I'm just wondering, where are you drawing your strength from at this time?
I draw my strength from my ancestors. I draw my strength from the land that I am deeply humbled to grow on Huichin Ohlone territory, a land that's grown and rooted many revolutions, many movements before me. And I draw my strength in my connection to my divine purpose, which is to heal myself, to heal the generational traumas that were perpetuated onto my lineage as a result of colonialism, patriarchy, white supremacy. And I honor that purpose with my breath and breathing into the knowing that by staying present, staying rooted, aware, that my spiritual guides and my ancestors will deliver me. So a deep breath, each deep breath to honor those sacrifices that they have made, that Breonna Taylor has made, that Mike Brown has made, that George Floyd has made, that Oscar Grant made, that breath that we get to have, making sure that that's a rooted breath that ensures our ancestors and those who have been lost to violence didn't die in vain.
Folks are looking to learn more about what you do and who you are and your traditions and rituals. Where would they go?
Yes, I would be honored to connect with y'all. My socials are at Sammy C Art, SamiSeeArt. I'm on Twitter, Facebook, and the Instagram. And you can find my work on my website, sammyc.com.
A deep, heartfelt thank you again to Bay Area muralist and healer Sammy C. Up next, we speak with Denise Asio, Native Hawaiian and longtime organizer for LGBTQI and Indigenous rights, now organizing for the Black Lives Matter movement. She's a healer and an artist and many more things, but Denise, I'll let you elaborate on that. Welcome to the show.
I am a Reiki master, so I'm a healer, and I also do a lot of creative artwork, from paintings, jewelry, handcrafting, candles and soaps, and so much more. You know, anything I can, any of my ideas, I just like to bring to life, so...
So a lot has changed, obviously. COVID has fundamentally altered the ways we live and create in the world. I'm wondering if you could speak a little bit about the evolution of your work amidst these changing landscapes that we're all trying to navigate.
I feel like this pandemic has allowed me to find the space to really discover my new potentials, or the potentials that I've always had as a creator. So prior to this, I was doing Reiki, I was bartending, and I was also holding a queer POC party every week. What's changed from then is physical contact, you know, the social distancing. It took me a minute to really process everything that was going on and like, what am I doing? Like, I'm just sitting around here, you know. I'm used to going to work, you know, the daily routines that you have. And so I finally, after a lot of self-care, started doing, you know, different art forms like, you know, meditations and prayers, but then venting through my artwork. I started doing a lot of painting, a lot of writing, going back to crafting my own soaps and just anything that I could get my hands on. And I didn't realize how much things in my house that I could actually do. Like, I could spend a lifetime just in my house with the things that I have. I was like, wow, I have all these things, you know? But I'm actually able to do the things that I've always wanted to do, but just didn't have the time for. Mm.
So I know when we spoke prior to this, you had expressed a desire, want to, after all of the restrictions ease from COVID, to hopefully make your art practice and your creations your main gig. And you were expressing that, you know, maybe you were coming to a realization that that was possible. And I'm just wondering if you could speak to that.
Yeah. As an artist, I feel like it's very vulnerable to express yourself. So a lot of times I didn't really have the confidence in showing my artwork, you know? So I got caught up in work. And after COVID, I was able to really like find it within myself that, you know, this is my form of expression and my feelings are valid. My emotions are valid and it's okay. Art is just beautiful, you know, like just really accepting myself. So I think that that's something new that I found within me. The things that you're most passionate about, sometimes you put on the back burner.
Sure.
Because you don't feel that you can survive off of, you know, something you're passionate about. You know, the money isn't really there to do creative work, you know. And I think after this COVID, we found that what's really essential, you know, to us, like, the underpaid people, you know, the healthcare workers, the teachers, the postal workers, the grocery store workers, the janitors, you know, those people have been brought to light and really shown that they're actually essential to us. And so is art. Artists are essential as well. So I've found that, you know, anything is possible, right? And it is possible to do what you're passionate about and make a living off of it.
Right on. So I just wanted to speak on, in the past few weeks and months, I've I've noticed a shift in your work, and please correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah.
It feels as though you've been incorporating a lot more socio-political elements, and definitely in solidarity with the Black Lives Matter movement.
I definitely, you know, been on the front lines protesting and stuff like that. I think a lot of my work has been evolving in a way where I'm not only expressing my personal experiences, but also the community's experiences and the injustices that we face in this world. So, and it affects us emotionally. And I think that what's changed in my artwork is that it is a collection of the emotions of pain and strength, you know, in solidarity with Black Lives Matter. And also as a Hawaiian native, you know, we're oppressed people as well. And we don't share the same injustices, but that doesn't mean we don't understand them or we don't feel that their pain. So however the Black community is fighting for their justice, we have to respect that, you know, and we had to be in solidarity with them, just how they were in solidarity with us on Mauna Kea. You know, their fight is our fight. And I think that it should be everybody's fight. I don't think that it's okay to stand by and just let these injustices be brushed under the rug. So in my artwork, I just feel like, you know, I'm really feeling that pain and grief and sadness along with them. And for my people too, you know, I mean, it's triggering, you know, of generational trauma. And it's time to speak up. I think that it is time to like answer our ancestors' prayers and be a voice for them because they were denied their freedom of speech. So through art, I believe that we are being their voice.
Mm.
And it's kind of exciting, you know, the awareness that's happening worldwide. And I think that this COVID really created that space for that.
The voice you just heard was that of Denise Acio, Oakland-based mixed media artist and healer.
And we're wrapping up another edition of Feminist Magazine. Don't forget, you can find all the links from our program today on our website, feministmagazine.org. You can find us on Facebook. The show is produced by a coalition of feminist volunteers. Our programs are archived in the kpfk.org audio archives. And you can find our podcasts. Thanks for listening.
What's going on, family, from the Bay to L.A.? My name is Kat Brooks. My show, Law and Disorder, is now on KPFK. Cutting-edge interviews with organizers, culture workers, newsmakers, and freedom fighters, the weekly state terror roundup, resistance in residence with artists using their gifts to change the world, and letters from the inside. That's just a small taste of what this show is about as we seek to expose, agitate, and build. Tune in Monday through Thursday at 8 a.m. on 90.7 or at kpfk.org.
The radio program Making Contact is now produced by KPFK and Pacifica Radio, and we're looking for volunteers to join our team. The station needs people who want to help book guests, conduct interviews, or script the show, especially bilingual English-Spanish speakers, people who have experience with audio editing, and someone who's skilled at enhancing interviews with archival footage, music, and sound effects. If you'd like to join this exciting transition and be a part of Making Contact's future, please email makingcontact@kpfk.org. That's makingcontact@kpfk.org.
It's one thing to love public radio, but it's a special thing to support it. Consider this. If you've got a car you don't need anymore, or you've got one that is simply too expensive to repair, arrange to donate it to KPFK. It's easy for you, pickup is free, and it could be worth hundreds of dollars in support. Thanks in advance, and here is how to get started. Go to kpfk.org/cars or call 877-573-5288. That is 1-877-KPFK-AUTO. And learn more.
KPFK is receiving support from a fundraising concert titled Stanley Clark and Friends, celebrating 50 years of school days, released October of 1976. The event takes place Wednesday, October 28th at the Alex Theater in Glendale. Scheduled performers include Stanley Clark, who is the music director for the evening, along with John Densmore and Robbie Krieger of The Doors,